Hey, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome to the School Sucks Live Show for Thursday, April 11th in some places and 12th in other places. On the phone with me tonight from Japan, James Corbett. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, but I think we have to retire the phrase on the phone.
Yeah.
We can say on the Skype.
Yeah. And we could, on the Skype, and we can take advantage of all that, like, cross time zone humor. James is in the future.
Hey, it's tomorrow where I am.
Yeah. James is from the Corbett Report. Can you tell us a little bit about that real quick, Lee?
Yes. My site is CorbettReport.com, and basically it's a news information website that is the host to my podcast, as well as my videos, interviews, and articles. And I've been working on that since 2007.
And you're also part of the Tragedy and Hope Network. That's where I was first introduced to your work. And I haven't been able to get into it, like with so many people's work, as much as I would like, but I'm always very impressed by everything I see. And I have to tell you, you seem like you have your hands in so many different topics and issues. So the first question I wanted to ask is just about your process. Like, how do you get organized? How do you decide what to pursue? Or do you have, I know you do some work for RT and a couple other sites. So is there, are they dictating where some of your attention needs to go, or do you just pursue what you want?
Well, no. Luckily, I've managed to maintain complete independence in terms of what it is that I'm going to be working on. I have a bunch of different sort of partners and people that I'm working with, but in every case, I've managed to maintain my independence. But yes, I'm working, for example, with the Center for Research on Globalization at globalresearch.ca, producing video reports for them. I'm producing a weekly video series for boilingfrogspost.com, the website of FBI whistleblower Sibelle Edmonds. I'm writing a weekly editorial for the International Forecaster, the newsletter of the recently deceased Bob Chapman. And I'm working with James Evan Pilato of MediaMonarchy.com. We do a weekly video series, New World, next week. Yes, I have my finger in a lot of pies, and it's really just sort of developed spontaneously through the years, just coming into contact with different people and deciding to start different partnerships. And in terms of the process by which all of this has developed, I mean, I think it's just been sort of a piecemeal process, and it gets to the point where there are more opportunities to do things than there are hours in a day. So I think, if anything, my biggest problem is trying to bite off more than I can chew, which I often tend to do. So for me, it's trying to rein that that impulse in and realize that I've probably reached just about the human limit of what I can produce in a 24-hour period.
So how did you actually get started? How long have you been doing this, and how did you get started?
I started in 2007. I started the website in 2007. I started the research for what actually became the Corbett Report in 2006, basically through a process of autodidactic learning. I started to discover things on the internet that really started to break down my paradigm, my understanding of the world and my perceptions of how that works. And it was a process that was extremely quick. Basically, it started around September of 2006 when I moved into a new apartment in Japan. It came with the internet, an internet connection with the apartment. So it was the first time I'd had the internet in my apartment for a few years. And in that intervening time, there were some different platforms like Google Video and YouTube, etc., that had cropped up, sort of new technologies. And so when I was browsing and going through this, and suddenly I started encountering all these documentaries about things that were fascinating to me, but that I'd never heard about before. And that eventually sent me down the rabbit hole, as it were. And within a few months, really, I had already decided that the discrepancy between the information I was encountering and the information that I'd had my entire life was just so great that I needed to start sharing that with other people. And just the first thing that really popped into my mind is, well, it's the internet age. Why don't I just start a website? And it was basically that simple. I just started developing the website. And then in a few months later, 2007, I came along and started it. And I haven't looked back since. And I could never have imagined in my wildest dreams that I would end up where I am right now, because it was never my plan to do this. But sometimes these things just creep up on you, and you just have to go with them.
Sure. And you do this full time now. This is pretty much your job as a podcaster and a reporter. And that's fantastic. Certainly something that I'm shooting for myself, and know, slowly but surely seem to be getting there. So I'm always interested in how other people are doing it and what's motivating them. But back to this this discovery period for you, I'm interested to know, do you remember the sites or the documentaries that really piqued your interest and made you say, whoa, there's a lot more out there to know?
I can't remember precisely what was the first thing that got me to where I am. I know that there was a lot of 9/11 truth information that I was encountering at that time that was really starting to change my paradigm, because I was not just passively encountering the information. I was trying to counter the information by trying to look it up and see what I could source and what I could verify and things of that nature. And when I started trying to disprove some of the things that I was finding in these documentaries, and then finding that not only could I prove them, I could also find information on other aspects of things that I had never heard about before. And that started me down the process of the dialectical process of coming into the sort of a dialectic with the information itself, rather than simply passively encountering it. And I think by that point, once someone reaches that level where they're actively starting to look up the information and try to find the answers for themselves, I think it's really just a matter of time before they do fall down that rabbit hole. But I do know that a couple of the documentaries that really affected me quite strongly during that period. One of them was The Century of the Self, the Adam Curtis documentary, BBC documentary, which is the first part of that, I think it's a three-part series, is absolutely outstanding and just has some incredible information and history in it. So I was quite blown away by that. But I think really the documentary that put the final piece of the puzzle into place for me was The Money Masters, which when I saw that and when I started to realize that there is more to the creation of money than I've ever been taught in my life, and that really is the central issue about how our entire civilization is organized, and that it can be controlled at the very top by a very few people. Once I started to process that information, it doesn't take very much for the penny to drop once it's been put into that position.
Sure. Back to Century of the Self, which I know we've mentioned several times on School Sucks before. It's the first part, I think the part that you were speaking of that is really impactful, deals with Edward Bernays, who is the father of public relations. I was really influenced actually around the same time, I'm thinking, by another film by Adam Curtis, who did Century of the Self, called The Power of Nightmares. Have you ever seen that?
I certainly have, yes.
And, you know, how did that... I remember for me, because it's interesting, James, around the same time, I was really into the 9/11 truth movement myself. I eventually started to feel like there was quite a bit of futility there. But it was probably around 2006 when I got my first MP3 player and I discovered Richard Grove's podcast, 9/11 Synchronicity. Yeah, and then I saw Power of Nightmares, which deals with the sort of the conflict between the ideologies of Islamism and neoconservatism. It didn't seem to jive exactly with everything else I was hearing. And that really, I think, brought my thinking to another level. I don't feel initially like I was going at it as critically as I should have. And I'm interested. It was interesting actually to hear you say that initially you wanted to hear these things, or you wanted to investigate these, you know, conspiracy theories or documentaries with the hopes of refuting them. And, you know, I remember being like so excited to just believe initially. And I mean, I wasn't necessarily gullible, but I had been a history teacher. I had been exposed to, like, at that point, Noam Chomsky and Howard Zinn, and a big part of their message is that things are not as you learn them in grade school and in high school. What was your assessment of The Power of Nightmares?
It has some very important information in that as well, and I think that's where the meme of Al-Qaeda doesn't actually exist really comes from for a lot of people. They still point to that first episode of Power of Nightmares, where they talk about how Al-Qaeda was basically created in a New York courtroom as a convenient vehicle for thereby trying Osama bin Laden in absentia. And that is an important piece of the puzzle, but I have since come to have a sort of, not a love-hate, but an interest-slash-disinterest relationship with Adam Curtis and his works, because he has this almost a radical position where he reads everything, all politics, at absolute face value. So that in The Power of Nightmares, for example, one of the ideas that he's putting forward is that it's kind of the neocons versus the Islamists. And he takes, for example, the neocons absolutely at face value. What they're really trying to do is spread democracy, and they believe it, that they're spreading freedom, et cetera, et cetera. And, but they're doing it wrong. And that, I mean, that to me is a fundamentally dishonest reading. I mean, I can't believe that anyone truly believes that that's what the Bush regime was actually trying to do. But if he does actually believe that, I think it's just hopelessly naive. So, in fact, I recently had an episode of my podcast where I went into some detail about this, recognizing that, again, Adam Curtis does some incredible work, but I think he has some fundamental flaws in his analysis as well.
Sure, yeah. And the reason why I asked you to elaborate was you were the producer, you were the maker of that short documentary, Al-Qaeda Doesn't Exist, correct? It's about 40...
Yes, I am. It's theoretically still ongoing, but I haven't done anything on it for 3 years now, so it's dead in the water.
It runs about, what, 40 minutes?
I think it was more like 30, but yeah, something in that range.
Yeah, so I remember watching it and seeing the title, and I just think it's such a challenge to explain that to people. And I think the emotions certainly come into it for so many people. I mean, I think we're so used to believing that. And even some of these neocons themselves, I think that that's a, you know, it's getting to be, unfortunately, a bigger tent, but it was a big enough tent during the lead up to the Iraq war, where certainly, yeah, you have people who are... you know, tricksters, for lack of a better word. But then it seems like there are some people in that documentary who earnestly believe that U.S. imperialism is this noble pursuit. I think a handful of those guys, and like I said, there seems to be just as many who know they're full of it, and they're pursuing a more complex or alternate agenda altogether.
Well, on that note, I mean, I think just as with any other ideology, there are going to be the actual believers. But I think that, like a lot of other ideologies, the people at the top realize that it is a convenient vehicle for the other interests that they have in mind and the other things that they want to bring forth. And when you start to look at the roots of the neocon ideology in people like Leo Strauss, who, of course, advocated the idea of the noble lie, I think we start to understand that it is an ideology which works by way of deception, of trying to deceive people about what its true intent and goals really are. And when you look at a lot of the core foundation of the neocons, Crystal and some of the others, who themselves were avowed Marxists in their early years and are now masquerading as neocons, it's not necessarily to say that they don't in some way believe in the other ideology, but at any rate, it accords in a way that provides them a convenient vehicle for what it is they're actually trying to do, which I think we can all understand is motivated primarily by, at the very least, economic concerns. Certainly, there's a lot of economic interest to be won from invading countries in the Middle East, and I think that that has to be at least a part of the calculus, rather than simply believing this is all about some noble ideology of trying to spread freedom or whatever, you know, ridiculous idea that they're trying to put forth.
Yeah, sure. Well, one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about that documentary, since it came up just for a minute, first of all, we covered this film there, this documentary that you made, Al-Qaeda Doesn't Exist. But also, one of the things that really struck me, even when I first saw it and understood a lot less about the philosophical undercurrents of so much of what we see showing up in the history books and in the news, they both have this common enemy. You know, and that enemy was individualism. Like both the neocons and the Islamists, or what people call Al-Qaeda. And as far as Al-Qaeda Doesn't Exist, I'm sure we both acknowledge that there are extremists who want to do these kinds of things. And what Curtis points out in the documentary is just the organization and the threat that was presented by American media and politicians did not exist. But they saw individualism as a threat.
Absolutely. You know, that's exactly right. As with any other basically with any other type of creed or religion or political persuasion that attempts to try to put people into a larger rubric, a larger sort of grouping that can then be puppeteered from the top down. Any type of centralized authority with top-down control is something that necessarily wants to subsume individual identity. And I think that that's something that that pervades everything that we see from the far left of the political spectrum to the far right and everything in between, and a lot of these religious ideologies as well. It's all about trying to basically subsume individual identity under various types of groupings. That's extremely convenient, shall we say, from the people at the top who are puppeteering those groupings and basically deciding what the ideology tells people they must or must not do.
Mm. So you talk about this period of discovery for yourself around 2005, 2006. You are in Japan at this time.
And that's right.
Were you, another thing that I wanted to cover here, you were an elementary school teacher in Japan. Were you doing that at that time?
I was in the private school teaching sector here at that time. So I got to Japan in 2004, and until 2007, I was teaching at a private school here. And then in 2007, I started teaching in the public elementary school system. And I continued that until 2011 when I started doing this full time.
So that must have been interesting as these two timelines, first your profession and then all of this research that you're doing, as they line up. How much did you know about the history or the intentions of, first of all, your own schooling when you started to pursue this as a career?
Very little, at least in terms of concrete data. I don't think that anything that I've learned has been completely surprising to me. It's certainly, I've never learned something that really challenged the way I thought that the world was working in a general sense, because I think I've always understood at some level that the education system is not exactly the ideal that that we are sometimes presented with. But it is, I mean, certainly some of the data points and things that I've encountered have been quite interesting. And one of them, I think, was the century of the self, which put into perspective, I think, to a great degree, what the way that, for example, the media can be used to manipulate people's perception. And I think it's not a big stretch to go from that to how our education works. And so now looking back on my own education in Canada growing up, I can sort of see all of those pieces of indoctrination. And then as I was sort of discovering all of this particular data, as I was there in the classroom, I mean, it was interesting to see the ways that that this is actually functioning at a nuts and bolts level here in Japan.
And would you say that the origins of Japan's system are similar? In other words, that they worked their way out of Central Europe in the mid-1800s, and that has pretty much become the model for all compulsory school systems in the world?
Absolutely so. In fact, Japan even perhaps more strongly so than in other places, because Japan actually ended up adopting the Prussian constitution and adopting Prussian education wholesale back in the late 19th, early 20th century. So I think Japan has really been sort of one of the shining models of this education system to a certain degree, at least theoretically, and it certainly has its roots in that strongly so.
Now, how did that affect you? I mean, what is the pedagogy like for elementary school? Would you say it was noticeably different, for example, more strict or regimented than what you experienced in Canada, which I'm guessing is very, very similar to the United States?
It was certainly more regimented than I would have expected. Of course, there is the uniforms here, so everyone wears the uniform, which in and of itself gives it almost a type of militaristic feel. At least at first glance, when you first see it, it is quite quite interesting in that respect. And then I think one of the first things that I ever encountered when I started teaching was when they got all of the children out into a big assembly out in the schoolyard as a way of introducing me to the school. And as they're coming in, I mean, each class is coming in, you know, kind of single file type of thing, and they line up on the field and that type of thing. And it was, I mean, just the overall impression was something almost like a military drill kind of thing. And over time, you start to realize that it's a little bit more controlled chaos than simply control. But it is still, that's the overwhelming impression that one gets at first. And it does look quite a bit different than what you would see in Canada, and I'm sure in the US as well.
So while you're spending the few years that you spent in that system, outside of it, you're learning all this stuff. You're having this real philosophical evolution. How did that affect what you were doing? Did it make it more difficult to go in there every day and to continue to participate in that system?
In some respects, yes. In other respects, I was resigned to the fact that I wasn't going to be able to basically affect much of a change or a revolution in the teaching that I was doing, simply because of the nature of the job and the fact that I was teaching at four different schools. And within that, I was teaching all different grade levels. So basically, I'd see the same class maybe once a month or something. So it wasn't really enough of a window to really start implementing anything revolutionary, even if I could. Basically, I mean, I was just teaching these children how to say I like apples or whatever. So it's kind of hard to introduce a revolutionary pedagogy in there. But it was interesting at any rate to be that fly on the wall and to sort of observe what was happening. And there were some things about the system here that I thought were if not good, unmitigatedly good, at least potentially a source of interesting contrast to what I'd experienced in my own schooling. So I point people to a very, very, very powerful documentary called Children Full of Life, which I believe is still available on YouTube for free viewing. And I hope people will take a look at that. That's an example of, I think, the best that you could possibly expect from the Japanese public schooling system. It basically follows the year in the life of a fourth grade teacher in a Japanese elementary school. And it shows, I think, some of the differences that you would find to the Western education system, because the Japanese education system is based, as certainly at the elementary school level, to a large extent on the idea of breaking classes into groups, and every activity and everything that happens throughout the school year is done in those groups. And it's really a system of the groups kind of policing themselves, rather than a teacher being the central authority that will tell the students how to act or behave. I mean, there is that to a certain extent, but I think there's a lot more sort of self-policing that goes on. And that manifests in different ways, including there are times here where the teachers will all go for a meeting and they will leave their classes completely to themselves for one or two lessons. Which would basically, from what I remember from my education, never ever happened in any school that I was at. There would always be a teacher present. So there is sort of more of that horizontal structure in the Japanese system, and that feeds in, I think, quite obviously to the Japanese society itself. When you look at the way that the Japanese society is structured, you see that it is more of a kind of horizontal, we're all in it together, let's work together in this kind of attitude here, which manifests itself on a societal daily level in an interesting way. And I think that's one of those things that an outsider can see quite clearly, that, oh, the education system directly feeds into society. And that starts to make you think about, oh, well, how about my education, my schooling, my upbringing? How did that affect it? And how does that feed into what Canadian or American society looks like today?
Sure. Yeah. You know, when obviously I'm far away, I've never even been to Japan. But when I first hear that about that's how the school community functions, part of me sees how that could be good, because it's encouraging, you know, self-responsibility and accountability to peers. And part of me, I don't know, there's is it just that they are left in these groups and doing this sort of self-policing, this horizontal policing, which is something that we certainly see a lot in our own society, I think, here in America, where, you know, I've said this on the show before, the CIA never calls me and tells me to stop doing, you know, but my uncle will, you know, he'll scold me for it. So we have a lot of that horizontal shaming and policing for our beliefs in America. And I wonder if the system there is just so efficient, considering its Prussian intentions, that it's more like programming. And I don't know because I can't see it. I'm glad to hear that it does have some positive, you know, outcome for society. But what would you say the respect for the individual is like?
Oh, I think that's absolutely the other side of the coin. And I think quite famously so. I mean, people, I've probably heard that in Japan, they have the saying, the nail that sticks up will be hammered down, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, individuality is very, very specifically drilled out of students from an early age and is basically gone by the time of adulthood to a large extent. So so that is something that is absolutely a hallmark of Japanese culture. And I think, again, directly stems from that early childhood experience. So I think there is definitely a negative aspect to this. I certainly don't want to come across that I'm saying this is all positive. But I guess the flip side of that is what's represented in that Children Full of Life documentary, where you do see the ways that the children are allowed to work through even some very deeply disturbing problems in their personal lives, the death of their grandmother and things like this, where the children will come together and basically empathize and work with their children, other children as kind of classmates and comrades, which again, it has its positive aspects, but again, also has that negative aspect of basically conformity, which is the defining characteristic of Japanese society. So you end up with a society where I have never anywhere in Japan ever at any time felt physically threatened or felt like I physically had to be careful where I was or be careful of my surroundings. It's the safest country, I think, probably on the planet, but that comes at a certain cost, the cost of individuality. And the pressure for conformity here is just, I mean, it's incredible. And I think that they're just as a culture, it is very much in that feudal mindset where there is still that kind of lord-vassal relationship between corporations and their workers now. And that's starting to disintegrate because of the shifting economic tides. But it's something that's still, I think, deeply ingrained in society here.
So all that being said, what's your social life like? Do you have friends there? Do you, share this, what you do with other people? And how does that go, if so?
I do have friends here. A lot of them tend to be other foreigners.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, a function both of the sort of social milieu here, of the foreign teachers kind of forming bands and sticking together, but I think also because of some of the linguistic barrier. I can hold a conversation in Japanese, but I think most people are... A lot of people are kind of afraid to speak to a foreigner because they learn English for a number of years, but they can't speak it, kind of like Canadians with French, or at least Western Canadians with French. So I can understand from that perspective. But so I do have some Japanese friends here, but for the most part, I tend to stick with other foreigners who I think understand my experience of the culture. But I've certainly broached the subject with these types of subjects with Japanese people before. And there is an undercurrent here that I think is interested in these types of subjects. It's certainly not the mainstream of the culture any more than it is in the United States or anywhere else. But there are pockets and undercurrents of society that are interested in pursuing some of these alternative ways of looking at things. But I'm not deeply ingrained in that, and to a certain extent, I think that perhaps even works in my favor, because I am kind of in my own bubble of a bubble over here, where I'm not immersed in American society, I'm not immersed in Canadian society, I'm not actually there, and I'm not also necessarily immersed in Japanese culture. I'm kind of floating away, in my own sphere here. So I can kind of come at this from an outside perspective, which kind of gives, I think, an interesting kind of outsideness to some of my work, which it provides a certain perspective that I think is interesting. It can be frustrating and it sometimes feels a bit lonely, I suppose, out here. But to a certain extent, I think it does work for my podcast and my ability to kind of approach every subject as a kind of outsider and taking a look on towards the inside to try to find out what's happening in the middle.
Mm. How long have you been there?
This is my 9th year now, so I've been out here almost a decade. The original plan was to be here for 1 year, but I ended up liking it, so I stayed for another, and then another, and another, and another. And here I am. Now I have a lovely wife and a child on the way next month.
Oh, congratulations. If you don't mind me asking, what was the plan originally? Why did you want to go to Japan?
It was honestly just one more way to sort of kill a year and have some fun and see a bit of Asia, which I'd never seen before, and avoid adult responsibility for another year. I was, I think, 24 when I came out here, 23, 24. So I was just basically looking for something to do for a year and to earn a bit of money while I did it. And it ended up being much more than that. I ended up really enjoying what I was doing, and it's something that you just can't really plan on. I didn't really have any preconception of Japan. I didn't even have any particular interest in Japanese culture or anything before I came out here. I really just wanted to see something different, and I ended up liking it a lot more than I thought, I guess.
Cool. So we were talking about, in the context of Japanese culture and society, individualism versus collectivism. I said our show would have kind of a free form. We wouldn't nail ourselves down to one topic. I feel like I have to cover this week before it is no longer time sensitive. The MSNBC anchor this week. Have you seen the promo that I'm speaking of?
Unfortunately, yes. Yeah. Yes, I have had the displeasure of sitting through that.
Like 20 people sent that to me this week, so I felt like I really wanted to address it on the show tonight. I don't really have too much new to say about it.
Melissa Harris Perry.
I'm sure if I just put her name into YouTube, that's going to be the third clip. All right. So, folks, if you are unfamiliar, this is not something that, you know, somebody allegedly said. This is not something that was quoted in some obscure book. This was not something that was captured by a hot mic. This is not even something the woman said in passing on her show. This is something that they wrote a script for and recorded as a promo because they thought it was such a profound notion. And this is Melissa Harris Perry. She has her own show on MSNBC. The title of this video is "All Your Kids Belong to Us," which is, I'm sure, not what MSNBC calls it, but well, maybe. I wanted to play it for you, and if you haven't heard it.
We have never invested as much in public education as we should have because we've always had kind of a private notion of children. Your kid is yours and totally your responsibility. We haven't had a very collective notion of these are our children. So part of it is we have to break through our kind of private idea that kids belong to their parents or kids belong to their families and recognize that kids belong to whole communities. Once it's everybody's responsibility and not just the households, then we start making better investments.
Well, first of all, James, I guess this is a debate that's going to go on in a box where kids belong to somebody, right? Just is it the community, which is a euphemism, I think, for academia and intellectuals in the state, or do they belong to their parents? So, yeah, this was very disturbing. I mean, these are things that appear in all kinds of books written by academics, certainly Gatto, you're probably familiar with underground history. He outlines this line of thought going back into the 19th century. So this is nothing new, really not even shocking to me anymore, or probably not to James either. But this format, this presentation of it, I found to be a little bit disturbing that this would be right out front and center like this.
It is disturbing. It certainly represents a sort of new stage of this type of propaganda.
Yes.
I mean, it shouldn't come as too much of a surprise, as you say. For example, people who are familiar with even Hillary Clinton's "It Takes a Village." I mean, that type of sentiment has certainly been in the air for quite a long time and has been trying to gain legitimacy in different ways. And I would put this back at least as far as the Communist Manifesto. abolition of the family, even the most radical flare-up at this infamous proposal of the communists. On what foundation is the present family, the bourgeois family, based? On capital, on private gain. In its completely developed form, this family exists only among the bourgeoisie. But this state of things finds its complement in the practical absence of the family among the proletarians and in public prostitution. The bourgeois family will vanish as a matter of course when its complement vanishes, and both will vanish with the vanishing of capital. Do you charge us with wanting to stop the exploitation of children by their parents? To this crime, we plead guilty. But, you say, we destroy the most hallowed of relations when we replace home education by social. And your education, is not that also social and determined by the social conditions under which you educate, by the intervention direct or indirect of society by means of schools, etc.? The communists have not invented the intervention of society in education. They do but seek to alter the character of that intervention and to rescue education from the influence of the ruling class. The bourgeois claptrap about the family and education, about the hallowed co-relation of parents and child, becomes all the more disgusting, the more, by the action of modern industry, all the family ties among the proletarian are torn asunder, and their children transformed into simple articles of commerce and instruments of labor. So again, this is not a particularly new idea that we must break down these relations and that these relations between parents and children are in fact a detriment. But of course, it is interesting to see it going this far, as you say, into this type of scripted comment that's coming as I don't even understand how this was presented. Was this like part of a commercial break, a PSA or something? That, I'm not sure.
No, that's exactly what it was.
Exactly. But it, I mean,
That's what was so disturbing about it to me. And, you know, I agree with what you're saying, that this kind of announces that this is going to a new level as far as what kinds of things it is okay to say and have the expectation that people will accept, you know, right out in the open. So this was recorded as a 30-second promo for NBC. We're at the end right now. I just paused the video with a second left. It's it says MSNBC, lean forward. So, yeah, that's these are the kind of things. I mean, I mentioned Gatto. I pulled out the book. I had it here, The Underground History of American Education. And there's a section called False Promises where he's talking about Edward A. Ross. Does that name ring a bell? He was a...
It does not, but...
He was a sociologist. But this is what I'm saying. This is how in the dark and in the shadows this stuff had to be. He's some obscure... sociologist. He wrote a book in 1901 called Social Control. And this was actually, I think we've heard phrases where children are referred to as, like you said, nails getting hammered, but lumps of dough. That came from this book. So this used to be something that a century ago in America anyway, which does, I guess, have perhaps a more individualist tradition than many societies, but those days are over. I mean, that is a statement that we would expect to have to hunt through an old dusty library to find in some obscure book, and now it is a mainstream media talking point.
Well, it's interesting to me from the outside perspective of a Canadian who's looking at American culture. I mean, one of the sort of bedrock principles of the foundation of America has always been independence. It's always been about the War of Independence, Independence Day. But I think the meaning of that word is becoming more and more obscured. And I think that the roots of that in autonomy, in sovereignty, in independence through not being dependent on any system or any group to identity in order to gain one's self-esteem, etc. I think that the real idea of independence is itself being eroded in American culture, which is a shame to see, because I think it truly has been. One of the furthest expressions of that has been in American culture. And it's certainly as a Canadian and as someone now in Japan, it's not something that manifests itself to that great a degree in, I think, any other culture that I've ever experienced. So it is interesting to see the ways that this is being broken down. And it is obviously something that will require a lot of conditioning to get people to sort of go along with, because the independence, the individualistic streak has been deeply ingrained in American society for hundreds of years now.
In name, at least, or, you know, the rhetoric of it has. How much in practice? That's certainly another question. But, you know, I mean, from what you've studied, from what you've seen, do you think there's any significant events that are worth mentioning in a timeline of the deterioration of that concept, whether it be in academia or in the halls of power? I mean, what do you think the changes were? I think a real significant one was 9/11 and the fact that the so-called conservative movement in America was basically, you know, between... Well, I mean, you know, it's something that had been going on with this infiltration into the Republican Party since the 1970s, but really grabbed hold of everybody after September 11th was this embrace of, or this real adherence to collectivism through the neoconservatives. But what do you think are some pivotal events or maybe even people, maybe in the last 100 years?
Well, I'd like to say to a certain extent, you can track it back to the foundation of the Republic itself.
Sure.
I mean, the idea of the nation and saluting the flag and the Pledge of Allegiance is, of course, always of trying to undermine individual independence and trying to put it into that collective group think in various ways. And I think that that was less of a concern hundreds of years ago because... there was that I think that the social environment which created a type of mental independence in a lot of people, and this was something that was written about by the founding fathers as well to a large extent. I mean, you had people like Jefferson talking about the yeoman farmer as the kind of ideal and warning about urbanization as a trend that would sort of disintegrate that independence which marked the early American spirit. And I think that is one of the things that I would look towards is the trend towards urbanization, which necessarily results in greater degree of social conformity and kind of subsumption of individuality. And also, I think that I see it also from an economic perspective and the formation of central banks, first the First Bank of the United States, the Second Bank of the United States, and then the Federal Reserve, I think has to be a key part of that calculus, because without that understanding of how the economic control functions and what type of society that creates, I think we can't really understand how those ideas manifest themselves, because the ideas are just expressions of various relations between human beings, and those relations themselves are mitigated by the economic context that they're steeped in. And when you have a central bank that is determining the form and the value of the medium of exchange, the currency that's being circulated, I think that is a key determinant of those social relations. And of course, everything else that happens in that economy, which unfortunately is basically the way that people relate to each other in most terms these days. So I would say perhaps even the foundation of the Federal Reserve in the past 100 years has been the one of the foundational cornerstones of this chipping away of individuality and subsumption of individual identity in a type of collective.
Yeah, the reason why I asked that question, just again, if you're just joining us within the last minute, I asked for some, you know, bullet points on the deterioration of the concept of individualism. And one of the things that I've really tried to wrap my head around as a student of history is, did it ever really exist? Certainly it's in the rhetoric of the founding documents, but we have this narrative that it seems like something at one point was very alive in the spirit of at least the people in this country. But has that just was it inserted at some point as folklore? I mean, the best I could track it down to was it seemed like the Civil War for me was a real turning point where everybody was asked to embrace the idea that this concept of the nation was more important than, first of all, the states, then their communities, then their personal relationships, and ultimately their own lives. And it doesn't seem like the United States ever returned from that. It seemed to actually be full speed ahead after that. And most of the things like industrialization, unionization, which of course I'm not saying is a bad thing, but it does have a collectivistic aspect to it. The Pledge of Allegiance, which was written by, I always confuse these brothers, Francis Bellamy, who was a socialist at the end of the 19th century. The development of compulsory school. It really seems like, first of all, obviously it's a confluence, but after the Civil War, that seems to be a very, very significant turning point. But the question that I can't answer, and I'm, you know, I've looked for the answers and read de Tocqueville, who you know, wrote about the United States before that, but I'm not sure. And sometimes it's hard to believe that individualism as a concept that everyone embraced, if that was ever real. So,
well, yeah. And let's step out of the box for a moment here, because of course, I mean, all we could ever be talking about in that context at the time of the founding of the Republic are wealthy white landowners. I mean, if right. you were anywhere else, anyone else, the idea of independence was not something that was even possible for you. So, I mean, there is a certain, obviously it was a type of a rhetoric that was not something that was lived up to by the society itself, but at the very least, it was the type of ideal that was more au courant at the time than the alternatives. The idea of subsuming your identity to the crown or to a kneeling before a king. So I think it was an important turning point in terms of breaking down some of the old ideologies that had held sway from the old world, But I agree. I mean, it was an ideal that was never actually lived up to. It was never something that was 100% played out. And I think that we have to look at it more as a type of progression or digression away from at least espousing the ideal. And now that they're coming out and basically trying to tell you that children are communal property and you should just give them to the state from the time of their birth, I think we have to see that at the very least for a fundamental change in the discourse, if nothing else.
Mm. I just want to go to our chat real quick. If anybody, I want to mention, first of all, if you're watching us on Ustream, you can watch us at schoolsucksproject.com/live and participate in a chat. If you want me, if you have a question perhaps for one of us, or you have a comment that you would like inserted into this discussion, since I am the only person minding the chat, I'm alone in the studio tonight, which creates a few technical hurdles, but type in all caps. That way I will be sure to see it. You want to hang with me for a few more minutes while I go through the chat and see if anybody has any questions?
Let's do it.
All right. And there might not be any, but I did see a couple people typing in caps, meaning that they wanted me to say this stuff on the show. The first person says, caps. Thank you. How do you feel the Ron Paul homeschool curriculum will be received by both homeschoolers and statists? Are you familiar with that?
I think I read a headline or something about there's going to be a liberty education thing or something, but I don't know any of the details about it.
Yeah, that's another thing that people are sending me. That's probably the number two thing I'm receiving from listeners this week is the Ron Paul homeschool curriculum after the MSNBC anchor station promo. All right, here's a good one. How does James feel about his experience moderating the debate between Stefan and Tom Wilkutz?
I really only saw my role as being sort of the person on the side, just sort of moderating the times and everything. So I didn't want to insert myself into the conversation. In terms of the debate itself, I think it tended to stray away from the actual debate topic, and perhaps that falls on me as the moderator, but I was allowing the two respondents to talk in the way that they wanted. But I felt that it strayed away from the fundamental point, is government immoral? I think that firstly, there was never really a point in which an agreed upon definition of government was ultimately arrived at. And then the question of morality, I think, tended to slip away as it became more of a conversation about what would be the effects of a stateless society versus a society with a government, rather than the underlying morality of it. So again, that might fall on me as the debate moderator, but at any rate, it was an interesting conversation, and it certainly spawned a lot of discussion on not only my YouTube posting, but also Stefan Molyneux's YouTube posting, also the Tragedy and Hope community. So hopefully it has gone some way toward facilitating that greater conversation that we're talking about here.
And my thoughts real quick, if the listener is interested, I watched it, and I don't know Tom. I know he's a mutual friend of Richard Grove and those folks in Connecticut. And he seems like a really nice guy. But what I said to James before we started recording is it seemed like he underprepared and then overprepared. And that might just be that he's new to the format of debating. I know he is an attorney. But it seems like he underprepared as far as understanding who Steph was and where Steph was really coming from. And really seemed kind of unfamiliar with his work. Like maybe he listened to the first couple episodes of Steph's podcast from 2005 or whenever that was. And I don't think he understood whether you agree with Steph or not, the sophistication and the depth of some of the arguments that he's made and the variety of topics that he has explored on his show. And then it seemed like he overprepared. He prepared a narrative, a set of tracks that he really wanted to stay on, that he really wanted to stick to. And it seemed to be sort of stiltifying as far as the whole conversation was concerned. So I was really anxious to hear him respond to Steph, but it seemed like he was not prepared to the point where he could properly respond to the questions that Steph was asking. So it was unfortunate. And I think if he keeps doing that, I know he's had a couple of tough customers in his debating career, Larkin Rose and Stefan Molyneux. I mean, debating Stefan Molyneux on the morality of the state is a very, very brave thing to do for a new debater. You know, hats off to him for that, but maybe he'll review those videos and improve his performance in the future. Somebody at 9:05, which was about 35 minutes ago, says, disagree. Deductive reasoning, certainty of truth, is different from inductive reasoning, non-certainty, just degrees of plausibility. I'm not quite sure what that is in reference to.
I don't know either, but I do agree. And I think it's important for us to understand, for example, that scientific understanding is inductive, not deductive, that empiricism is based on the idea that we are always subject to revision based on new data. And that's something that I think is not properly appreciated by at least a lot of the lay public that wants to think of scientific truths as internal enshrined truths that do not come from a certain paradigm or perspective, which, of course, even the briefest look at the history of science would show to be false, looking at, for example, the shift from a Newtonian perspective to an Einsteinian perspective, et cetera, et cetera. So it is important to understand that difference. And when it's phrased like that, I certainly wouldn't disagree with that. There is a substantial difference between deductive and inductive reasoning.
The next person says, Islam, Christianity, and Judaism all use deductive reasoning to claim that the truth they found makes sense and is logical. Actually, those comments both come from the same person. So that's a.
I don't know. Is that true? Do those religions claim that their truth is logical, or do they claim that it is a revealed wisdom of God that is inaccessible by any other method?
Yeah, and your only interface as a follower of that religion is faith. There's really no research or logical analysis required, as far as my understanding, certainly as far as my Roman Catholic upbringing was concerned, there was no need to bring logic into it or even curiosity. I remember being scolded in the pews of the church one day by a nun for trying to figure out exactly when Jesus existed. They didn't explain the AD BC thing to us very well, James, and we were told that BC meant before Christ and AD meant after death, but there was no period in the middle called the life of Jesus. So we were kind of
only you had some more Latin in that education.
Well, this was outside of school. This was at catechism class for right. Which is part of Roman Catholicism and doing the sacraments. So, me and my other 8-year-old friends waiting to earn the sacrament of confession, I believe, we're trying to make sense of this. Did they crucify an infant? What was the story here? Did time stop during the life of Jesus? And the nun came up and told us that was an inappropriate conversation. So, yeah, I think
certainly I would say that, again, I come from a Protestant Christian background, upbringing, but I would say definitely that in terms of the doctrine, that to me, is about faith and about the revealed word of God or whatever, not about anything that's logically, deducible or arguable. But I think that there has been an overplay of the sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? The not discrepancy, but the incompatibility of religion and science. I mean, I think that in history there have been certainly times in which scientific reasoning has gone in the face of religious dogma, and there has been that clash. And I mean, you can look at Galileo or whoever, but I think that there's also been fostering of scientific understanding within religious societies. I don't think they're necessarily mutually exclusive, but when it comes to the articles of faith, I think certainly those are off limits to the logical argumentation.
Sure, sure. And, I hate to be negative, but most of them would collapse pretty quickly if they were subjected to that. So... another person asked, what is Brett and James' take on Thomas Zaz and the myth of mental illness? Are you familiar with that?
The name rings a bell, but off the top of my head, I'm not familiar enough to comment.
S-Z-A-S-Z. I'm not familiar either. I can certainly look into that. Really need to hire a guy who reads me the chat. That would be a very helpful part of the process here. Do you think that this goal for global government has been a conscious conspiracy of several bloodlines throughout history, or do you think it is just a mind virus that affects certain people?
Can I say both? Would that be a cop-out? Because I think it's, to me, there is a very obvious progression from the old more religious-oriented society in which the fundamental authority for the fundamental justification for authority came from the divine right of kings, for example. In fact, if you go far enough back, the pharaohs and the emperor of Japan and others were worshipped as gods on earth. They were actually gods. The development of that idea through monotheism and the introduction of Judaism and then Christianity, etc., became the authority was displaced into God, and then that authority was kind of granted to kings. There was the divine right of kings to rule. But after that paradigm started to collapse, and certainly by the time you get to the 19th century, that idea had well played itself out, and you're starting to see the rise of nation states and democracy and these types of ideas. So where is the justification for authority in that system? And I think that there needed to be a scientific construction for that. There needed to be some sort of scientific way that you could try to justify authority. And that's exactly precisely when and where and in the context in which you find the rise of eugenics as an ideology, which has that scientific basis. Oh, it's about genetics. It's about certain people have genes, and there are certain bloodlines that just by their very nature are better suited to be rulers of society. So it was that scientific justification that came along, just as I think there needed to be a different justification for this at the end of the day. So I think it's one that self-evidently plays exactly into the old system. I mean, just as before, there was this divine right of kings, which transferred from father to son, from generation to generation. Well, now there's just this divine right of genetics, I guess you could say, that certain genes are just better suited to propagating and to controlling others. So they transfer in family lines. I think it's all, I mean, faulty and provably so. I mean, eugenics is quack science, and obviously it's been completely debunked. But I think there are still people who are motivated by that, because of course it gives them that justification, whether or not they truly believe it themselves or whether it's just a convenient excuse to try to wield authority over other people. At any rate, it does provide that type of justification.
Yeah, it seems like people always need to tell themselves that story, right? Like that's always, or maybe they don't need to tell themselves the story. Maybe they need to tell the people the story. But we talked about the concept already in this show of rationalization, and I've described it on the show before as, you know, an ex post facto explanation for an action or a thought or a statement that was emotion driven. You know, so is there something in the makeup of certain people? Are certain people unwell in such a way that they want to wield this power over people? And, you know, then got into these habits of making up the reasons why after that course was already chosen through some kind of maybe even compulsion that they didn't understand themselves. And, you know, at first the story was like James said, you know, I have magic powers. Then the story was, well, the guy with magic powers chose me to do this on Earth. And then it was the people gave me magic powers because they fill out some paperwork every November. And it seems like the more the world embraced science, the more the rationalizations became scientific, which gets us up to where you were talking about with eugenics, which is a very real thing. I know this is territory that we don't tread into a lot on my show, but we have covered it a little bit. And I know I already mentioned An Underground History. Gatto talks about it a lot in that book.
It is so important to understanding, I think, the forms of social control, because they spring directly from the eugenics ideology. And it's very much the same people, the same gentleman scientists of late 19th century England who were working on that. And just to make that linkage even more explicit, I mean, it's famous, of course, that the European royalty for centuries has inbred. And in fact, even if you go back to Egypt and the pharaohs, etc., they were all inbred as well. And this is part of that idea of passing on the family line, and you don't want to pollute that line with anything outside. In the same way, the eugenicists also had this idea. And if you look at Charles Darwin, for example, marrying his first cousin, or if you look at the Darwin-Wedgwood line, it's two families that were so interbred that at a certain point you had cousins marrying cousins who were themselves were products of cousins who had married cousins, etc. And you get people like Charles Darwin, of course, and then his cousin was Francis Galton, who was the person who coined the term eugenics and really founded the eugenics ideology. And their descendants were people like Charles Galton Darwin, who was Charles Darwin's grandson and a person who wrote a book like The Next Million Years, talking about the ways that we must control society, control and direct evolution by controlling, for example, uppity children by giving them vaccines that would take away their ability to fight against the system and things like this, which again sounds just completely out there until you actually start to read the writings of these people. And the people from this Darwin, Wedgwood, Galton family line that itself was so interbred with people like the Huxleys as well, yeah. Who also fit into that. And of course, you have Aldous Huxley writing Brave New World, not about some far off weird speculation he had, but about things that he was actually witnessing. And if you go back to his final speech at Berkeley in 1962 called The Final Revolution, The Ultimate Revolution, he talked about that quite specifically and some of the experiments of direct control of people's brains and things that he had been witnessing, planting electrodes into people's brains to try to see how they could affect their reasoning centers and their emotions, etc., directly through electronic impulses and all of this. So he was writing from within that context as someone who had seen it sort of on the inside. And I think it's important for people not to just dismiss this as science fiction, but to actually look at the actual people who were developing this ideology, because I think that is something that's extremely important to understand. Why are people trying to mentally cripple others with the education system that has been instituted, etc.? And I think it does go back to an ideology that truly does posit that there are certain bloodlines that do deserve to be rulers over humanity.
Well, the other thing too, before people dismiss these things, they should really look at the nuances and the steps, right? Because somebody would be jumping the gun if they say, look, we're all under mind control right now because MKUltra. Well, that you left out a bunch of stuff. Okay. So initially, like we're talking about a lot of the Fabian socialists or people like them, people who thought like that. A lot of them were in England in the latter years of the 19th century. You know, first we have the idea and the intention. Then we have experimentation. and then we have implementation, and then we have success. The only thing that people, I think, should really, really, really be incredulous about at this point, considering all the documentation that's available, is the success. Were these things carried out, whether we're talking about vaccination or mind control, to a point where they had mass success? And I still question a lot of that, but the ideas are real. That should not be controversial. The material is available. In a lot of cases, the implementation was real, even on a small scale. And before that, there was a lot of experimentation. But a lot of people look, I think, at experimentation, for example, the MK Ultra program, and they say, ah, and that is why we are all under the, you know, spell of the government today. And there's a lot that's missing from that. So when we talk about intentions as far as vaccinations are concerned, there's a lot more that could be added to that conversation. I just want to make that clear for my audience, because this is obviously a very, very controversial subject, and because I am not an expert and have not taken the time to do the research, it is not a place where I have spent much time on the show. Purposefully.
Well, once again, I would just encourage people to actually go back and read some of these writings for themselves and try to come to their own conclusions about how that was implemented. But in terms of the implementation of eugenics, it's vital that people understand how that was funded by families like the Rockefeller family. Yes. Through the Cold Spring Harbor Institute in the United States and through the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in Germany in the 1930s, which was the scientific basis for Nazism. And when that was discredited, then it's important to understand how eugenics turned into crypto-eugenics, which was a term that was coined in the 1950s by members of the British Eugenics Society, who then started to shift into discourse on population control rather than simply talking about trying to weed out the inferior genes.
Right.
And again, there's a rich history to be mined there, which I've covered in some degree of detail in my podcast in the past, so people might be able to use that as a starting point for their own research.
Mm, absolutely. And that's certainly something we could talk about a lot more. It's a fascinating subject. I know I've taken up a lot of your time. Can we do one more softball question?
Let's do it.
What are some other media producers that James likes or follows?
Yes, you're going to put me on the spot because I'm going to forget to mention people and they might get angry. But for example, Stefan Molyneux, I listen to his podcast. I think what he's doing is extremely valuable. And he was one of the people who helped to break down my last vestiges of statism. So I'm eternally grateful for that. Obviously, the Tragedy and Hope podcast is always, the Peace Revolution podcast, I should say, is always informative and valuable to listen to. I work with James Evan Pilato of MediaMonarchy.com. Unfortunately, he doesn't do his podcast anymore, but he has a big archive of really interesting podcasts that he put together. You're going to make me try to think about this. Obviously, BoilingFrogsPost.com is, a great place where it's got a lot of different, it's got four different podcasts and my video series. And the four different podcasts are from people coming from each from a slightly different perspective. And I think all from a very different perspective from myself. So I think it's valuable in that regard. So I hope people will check into those podcasts. And I listen to, for example, I listen to the Jack Blood Show. I listen to a lot of financial types of things from different perspectives, both mainstream opinions and alternative, Gold Seek Radio, Financial Sense NewsHour, things like that. I listen to a wide range of different media on a regular basis. So again, I'm apologizing to the people who I'm inevitably leaving out on this, but those are some starting points, I would say, for some good media.
Excellent. It's good that you're still finding time to listen to stuff. I can't seem to do it.
It's not easy.
No. No, especially something like with you, my thing is that, like I mentioned Rogan, I can listen to that no matter what I'm doing, cause I can just put it on and let it play. But for example, like your podcast today, I was listening to an episode that was about 1 hour long, and it took me an hour and a half to listen to it, cause I had to pause, think about it, what I was hearing, process it. And that's great. And I love being able to do that process. It's just, I don't always have time for that. You know, there's comedy shows that I like that I can just put on and, you know, if they could be on a radio, I can walk out of the room and come back and, no big deal. But, you know, something that's a little bit more in-depth and scholarly, especially Peace Revolution. I mean, I could spend 9 hours dealing with one of those episodes. Partly because Rich made it 6 hours long, but, you know.
Yeah, that's a big contributory factor.
Yeah, 3 hours.
No, I agree. I mean, this is the type of media that does require your attention. But luckily for me, this basically is my entertainment, and I don't have much of a life outside of this. I mean, I truly do this because it's what I think about, and it's what I do, and it's what I eat, sleep, and breathe. And that's not something I'm forcing myself to do. It's something I'm just genuinely motivated by my desire to learn more and more and more, and I can't imagine that process is ever going to stop. So I'm glad that there are other people out there that are putting out quality media that I can rely on for sources of information.
Great. Can you give us your sites and anything else you'd like to plug before we let you go?
Just CorbettReport.com is kind of the one-stop shop for all my work, CorbettReport.com. And there you can find my podcasts, interviews, articles. You can find links to the other websites I'm associated with. And you can also find about my subscriber newsletter and my DVDs, etc. if you want to help support the work. But basically, that's the place to go if you want to find out more about myself or what I'm doing.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for your time. It was great to have you on finally. And I hope we can do this again in the future.
I'm looking forward to it anytime.
All right, James, have a good night.
All right, take care.
Bye.
Bye, Johnny.